the headlines this hour. Iran rules out any bilateral talks with the U.S. on the 2015 nuclear deal, calling on Washington to live up to its commitments under the accord. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it brought down an Israeli drone that had violated the Lebanese airspace. Also coming up, Indian police step up security and block main roads leading to the capital, New Delhi, to prevent protesting farmers from entering the city. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muniz. Thanks for joining us. Iran has once again emphasized its stance on the 2015 nuclear deal, reiterating that Tehran is awaiting Washington's action.
Iran is waiting for the U.S. to act, which means the removal of sanctions effectively. We want to see all sanctions are lifted, which former U.S. President Donald Trump had imposed on Iran in violations of international laws and accords, including U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 and the JCPOA.
Khatibzadeh said it would not be sufficient to see some developments on the paper. Rather, Tehran wants to see the sanctions are lifted in real. The spokesman also ruled out any bilateral talks with the U.S. on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, urging the new U.S. administration to correct the wrongdoings of its predecessor. Iran started scaling down its JCPOA-related commitments since the U.S. withdrawal from the deal and its reimposition of unilateral sanctions. Tehran has time and again said that its move is reversible if other parties abide by their commitments under the deal. Indian police have beefed up security, blocking main roads leading to the capital, New Delhi, in an effort to prevent protesting farmers from entering the city. Police and paramilitary forces have dug up trenches and put razor wires on highways as the finance minister is set to deliver annual budget plan in Parliament. The security is stepped up around Parliament and other public buildings. There are also internet and communication blackouts in several neighborhoods. The move comes days after a tractor rally by farmers on Indians' Republic Day turned violent, with some protesters storming into the capital's iconic Red Fort. Farmers have been protesting for months, demanding the government repeal a set of agricultural laws. The government rejects the call, arguing the reform is aimed at boosting rural economies. A correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says the Indian government never expected its agricultural reform laws to cause such havoc in the country.
Looks like this issue has backfired for the government. The government tried everything possible in its capacity to do with these laws. They wanted to pass the agricultural reform somehow, but it was unexpected. It was unexpected that this farm law, agricultural laws that the government has passed, it will create such a havoc inside the country. It's right now, as we speak, the protest is gaining momentum. Yesterday and today, there are more and more people converging at protest sites, and the farmers are gaining a lot of public sympathy. I mean, people are connecting with them. So right now, the government has beefed up security in New Delhi. I'm just coming from the board, adjoining areas of New Delhi, that's Ghazipur. I could see the barricades all across the roads leading to the border areas. The security and paramilitary forces are in high numbers on the streets.
Myanmar's ruling junta has announced a purge of the government of Aung San Suu Kyi after seizing power in a coup Monday. Junta leaders removed 24 ministers and appointed their own picks for 11 ministerial portfolios, including for defense, interior, and finance. Coup leaders have declared a one-year state of emergency. They say power is now in the hands of the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. They claim the last parliamentary elections were fraudulent. They have put the de facto ruler, Suu Kyi, and her key officials under detention. Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy has urged the public to protest against the military coup amid communication blackouts and military patrols in the country's largest city of Yangon. Earlier we talked to international lawyer Barry Grossman about the root cause of tensions in Myanmar.
Military junta, which has always been sitting there in the background, might have something to say about the direction the country's been moving in, or not moving, as the case may be. And of course, the junta, along with opposition parties, have taken the position that the recent election in 2020, in November, was also replete with election fraud. And it's worth noting that in that election that the NLD, that is Aung San Suu Kyi's party, won 396 out of 476 seats. So that was really very much a massive win for them. But even the Election Commission has admitted that there were some substantial problems with election lists. And of course, the opposition have claimed, along with the military, that there were millions, literally 8 million individual cases of election fraud that they identified, something disputed by the Election Commission. But it's also important to recall that as far as elections go and democracy goes, many electorates were banned from participating in the election. The entire state of Rakhine was, to one extent or another, excluded. Certainly, Rohingya Muslims that remain in Myanmar were excluded from voting, as well as some other ethnic minorities. So it's hard to really see that even the 2020 election is some kind of pillar of democracy.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that it downed an Israeli drone after it violated the Lebanese airspace. Hezbollah said in a statement that the drone was brought down near the border town of Bida. The movement said that it is now in the control of the drone. The Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spy operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. Let's get more information on this. Maryam Saleh is a correspondent joining us from Beirut, and we also have Laith Maruf, who's an activist and political commentator, also joining us from Beirut. All right, Maryam, first over to you. So what is the deal here? Because we see, on the one hand, we have Hezbollah saying that it downed this drone. On the other hand, Israel says that the drone just actually went down by itself.
Well, actually, with the Israelis, you always have that type of scenario. We always hear that, of course, from the Israelis. Hezbollah did say that they were able to discover that drone and down it. Now, you know, these types of drones usually fly below the radar, so it's not easy to detect them. Even the Israeli Army radio itself has said that Hezbollah has sent even drones over their military sites. They don't always get the chance to also discover them. Usually, and they tend to come back to Lebanon safely with all the information that they can collect. But with the Israelis now, it seems that Hezbollah is able more, since they have more people within, you know, those villages that are very much near the border, very closely monitoring. So they were able to monitor this, cover it, and take it down. So this is considered, of course, a very significant achievement for Hezbollah's resistance. And what we can see here is that Hezbollah has promised that they would, find a solution to these issues, or at least try to make sure that, or tell the Israelis and send the message that we will be following up any sort of those violations. Of course, you have the warplanes, which are also there basically on a daily basis. You also have the larger and unmanned planes, which are perhaps more difficult to take down in some cases not. But what we're seeing here is basically a new type of war evolving, unfolding with Hezbollah and the Israelis, mainly a war of drones. And this started, you can say, mostly back in August of 2019, when the Israelis sent a suicide drone. And Hezbollah since then has been adamant on trying to stop that, but still the violations, especially for Lebanon's airspace, continue.
Okay, so let's move. We have, first of all, on the one hand, how Lebanon's airspace has been violated so often on a daily basis, as a correspondent has been reporting for years. I believe it was last week, or maybe a little bit longer than that, that you had F-35 Israeli jets actually fly over Lebanon's airspace. So that's one note there, and I'd like to find out from you what you think about that, because that's not something that's common when it comes to the violation of Lebanon's airspace.
We have to keep in mind that the last speech by Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, he referred to the fact that they have downed many Israeli drones and have not revealed it to the public, and that as a result of those actions by Hezbollah, those successes, the apartheid regime has been sending fighter jets, F-35s, as we've seen last week, and F-15s, to accompany those drones. They can't anymore fly drones easily into Lebanon without those drones being downed. Therefore, now they're flying their actual war jets to accompany those drones to give them protection. And in this situation, this is a smaller drone. It's not one of those long-distance ones that didn't have any helicopter or air jet protection and was downed by Hezbollah. We also have to note that within 24 hours before that, less than that, 12 hours before that, in Gaza, the Palestinian resistance also downed a drone that is very similar. It's almost the same kind. So there is a coordination between Hezbollah and the resistance in Gaza, and there's an exchange of expertise on how to bring down Israeli drones. So there's a change in tactics that is that we're witnessing right now.
I know I've asked this question from you, Mariam, many times, but when you get these violations of this airspace, in particular drones that are happening, first of all, what does it do? I mean, where do these drones go? Are they just taking information off aerial information on particular sites, maybe? But then they're violating the airspace every day. So what are they up to?
Well, basically, you have several folds to this issue. First of all, you have the reconnaissance job that they do, trying to make sure that they have updated their data concerning the targets that they have here in Lebanon, whether it is any sites for Hezbollah, even sometimes social schools, sites they probably had before the year 2006, after the 2006 war. The other thing is always this, the fact that the Israelis are always sending threats against Lebanon. This is always threatening Lebanon's security, threatening Lebanon's stability. And this is what we always hear from the government. The official stance is that, and this is what the Lebanese complaint is usually about every time we have this violation. It is reported by the Lebanese army, and then the government, in its turn, sends a complaint to the United Nations, and that is mainly one of the main issues. It is considered a threat to Lebanon's national security, of course, from the Lebanese side. The Israelis, of course, are also, this is part of their tactics, this is part of their psychological warfare as they continue with it. Of course, they've always had this type of warfare, in addition to the fact that they want to show their military supremacy. This is, of course, in addition to the surveillance and the reconnaissance jobs that they need to do. But this, of course, has changed throughout the years, because in the past we used to see the warplanes and then we had shelling after that. Nowadays we only have that type of violations, if you may say, only provocations of violations. And of course, the Israelis, because now they understand, they have always said it several times, several Israeli officials continue to repeat the fact that if they do launch any sort of aggression against Lebanon, they know that there will be a retaliation by Hezbollah's resistance.
Thank you for that, Mariam Saleh. Appreciate it. Leif Maruf, thank you, activist and political commentator from Beirut. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. The Taliban have called on the U.S. to abide by its commitments under its 2020 agreements with the militant group.
We did not reach an agreement for a period of 4 years. In other words, we have reached an agreement with the U.S. establishment. They should remain committed to their undertakings.
Taliban's political bureau chief said Washington has pledged to withdraw its forces within a 14-month time frame. He warned that the group will reassess its agreement with the U.S. if Washington does not do so. The official said the presence of American forces after the 14-month period means the continuation of the U.S. occupation. The group vowed to continue its military operations as long as the U.S. maintains its presence in the country. The Taliban and the U.S. signed an agreement last February following negotiations in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement called for the withdrawal of American troops from the war-torn country. Bush has lashed out at the U.S. and the European Union after they denounced Moscow's response to recent protests in the country. Dmitry Polyansky, Russia's first deputy permanent representative to the U.N., accused the EU of pursuing double standards toward Moscow. That after EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell said that Russia has resorted to widespread detentions and disproportionate use of force against protesters and journalists. The Russian Foreign Ministry also accused the U.S. of gross interference in the country's affairs after Washington made a similar allegation. Several Russian cities have witnessed rallies in the past days over the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Hundreds have been arrested during the demos, which the Kremlin calls unauthorized. One more incident of police brutality in the U.S. Body cam footage released by police in the city of Rochester shows officers spraying a 9-year-old black girl with pepper spray while handcuffed. The girl was seen being forced to get inside a patrol car while she was crying and calling for her father. The Rochester Police Department claimed the officers responded to a report of family trouble and used force when the girl refused to follow commands. However, Rochester's mayor condemned the force against the kid and pledged an internal review of the city's law enforcement practices. Also, the city's police chief called the incident unacceptable. The footage sparked fresh outrage over police brutality against African Americans. U.S. police are infamous for racial profiling against minorities, especially people of color. France has imposed tighter border controls to try to stem the spread of COVID-19, as the continent is struggling with the coronavirus and its new variants. French border police have turned away passengers bound for non-European Union countries. This comes as the country shut its borders to all but the essential travel to and from countries outside of the bloc. Over the weekend, the number of COVID-19 patients in French hospitals hit a 9-week high. In the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the country's infection rates remain at a very high level and there can be no premature easing of lockdown measures. Britain has already tightened restrictions over a more transmissible strain of COVID-19 detected in the country. The COVID-19 pandemic and its economic impacts have turned out to be a curse for workers around the world, but a boon for billionaires. Over the past year, the richest people on Earth have seen their wealth grow, while millions were out of their jobs. Similarly, people have been losing their income at unprecedented levels. Is there a global recovery plan on the horizon?
The coronavirus pandemic battered the global economy like nothing else has done for decades. Prolonged nationwide lockdowns in some countries and mismanagement of the crisis in others have all contributed to 2020 becoming one of the gloomiest years for the global economy. It's not surprising to learn, according to a new report from the International Labor Organization, that workers around the world have lost $3.7 trillion since the pandemic began. Globally, 8.8% of working hours were lost, and 114 million people experienced employment loss, what the report called an unprecedented level. What's shocking is another report that made headlines. Billionaires around the world, who initially suffered massive losses like everyone else, have seen their wealth increase by $3.9 trillion as the entire globe has been grappling with the impacts of the deadly respiratory disease. That figure, according to the Oxfam report, is enough to vaccinate every single person on Earth against the coronavirus and help them stay out of poverty. In the meantime, the workers may have to wait for a decade to be able to recover the losses they sustained. The report also estimates between 200 million to 500 million people may have fallen into poverty during 2020.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Republican Party leaders will meet with extremist Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene next week as an ongoing crisis over her racist and bizarre political views continues to roil American politics. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Republican Leaders to Meet with Marjorie Taylor Greene Amid Calls for Removal. Stay with us for more. Republican Party leaders will meet with extremist Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene next week as an ongoing crisis over her racist and bizarre political views continues to roil American politics. Meanwhile, Marjorie Greene tweeted on Saturday that she had had a phone call with former President Donald Trump, which she described as great, and that she was so grateful for his support, probably cementing her position as a champion of the far-right Trumpist wing of the Republican Party. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has in the past expressed support for the racist QAnon conspiracy movement, has been the subject of a number of media reports revealing her past posts on social media that support or promote a range of fringe, violent, and bigoted ideas. Some important outside groups have demanded the Republican Party condemn her, and Democrats are pushing for Greene's removal from Congress, or at the very least, that she be taken off the important committees that she's been given positions on. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican House leader, will now sit down for a conversation with Marjorie Taylor Greene next week, his office said. But Republican leaders have so far offered no meaningful condemnation of Greene or indication that we'll take any action against her. Greene herself has remained angrily defiant in the face of the criticism, though her Facebook profile has had many posts removed. I will never back down, I will never give up, she said in a statement on Friday, 29th of January. Since arriving in Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene has become a symbol of how far to the right much of the Republican Party has moved under Donald Trump, and the continued influence of extremists in its ranks, especially after the 6th of January attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob. Democratic Congresswoman Cori Bush said on Friday she is moving her office away from Marjorie Taylor Greene due to safety concerns after Greene and her staff berated her and refused to wear face masks. Cori Bush told MSNBC she is moving her office not because I'm scared of Greene, because I'm here to do a job for the people of St. Louis. What I cannot do is continue to look over my shoulder wondering if a white supremacist in Congress, by the name of Marjorie Taylor Greene, is conspiring against us, she said. Calls for action against Greene have grown louder as more and more reports have emerged of her extreme views. In past social media posts uncovered by CNN, Marjorie Taylor Greene indicated support for executing Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton. In a 2018 Facebook post reported by Media Matters, she echoed conspiracy theories that the wildfires that ravaged California that year were caused by a laser beam from outer space, triggered by a group of Democratic politicians and companies for financial gain. In a 2019 confrontation with survivors of the Parkland mass shooting, documented on tape, she appeared to accost the students and later echoed conspiracy claims that Mass shooting survivors and family members of victims are crisis actors, and that attacks that killed their loved ones were staged as a plot to pass gun control laws in the United States. Some of Marjorie Taylor Greene's views embrace anti-Semitic tropes, and that has prompted some Republican Jewish groups to speak out against her. The Republican Jewish Coalition said on Friday it is working with PART leaders on next steps and noted that it opposed Greene's 2020 election because she repeatedly used offensive language in long online video diatribes and promoted bizarre political conspiracy theories. Meanwhile, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, which includes major conservative Jewish lobby groups like AIPAC and American Friends of Likud, among the 53 Jewish groups it represents, issued a strongly worded condemnation and call for action against Marjorie Taylor Greene. The group said Greene was spreading baseless hate against Jewish people and called for a swift and commensurate response from political leaders. Elsewhere, the Human Rights Campaign has called for McCarthy to remove Greene from her committee assignments. There must be consequences for her actions. The Human Rights Campaign calls on House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to hold Marjorie Taylor Greene accountable and remove Representative Greene from all her assigned congressional committees at the very least, said Human Rights Campaign President Alphonso David.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome to the subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we will walk through the Khaf Herat Railway and explore the consequences of this strategic line for the future of trade and transit across Asia to the Western world.
Recently, Iran sent its first cargo of exports to Afghanistan via the new Khaf Herat Railroad as a trial dispatch to detect possible technical problems and issues on the 220-kilometer-long route of the Iran-Afghanistan Rail Corridor. This is a part of a long-sought rail network which is planned to go from Iran to Afghanistan and China, either directly or through Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, facilitating transport of goods and services to Europe and the Western world.
The Khaf Herat Railway was inaugurated with a trial freight train that delivered about 500 tons of cement from Iran to Afghanistan, while a passenger train also took Iranian officials to Afghanistan for a meeting. The Khaf Herat line is part of a bigger east-west railway corridor project which extends from China to Europe through Iran and Afghanistan. The railway connects Iran's eastern city of Khaf near Mashhad to Afghanistan's western city of Ghorian in the Herat province.
This is a very important project, this new railway connecting the two countries, for a variety of reasons, of course, economically, but also it demonstrates to the world that despite the U.S. aggression against both countries, progress still proceeds. This is a significant achievement. And this gives people hope, for one thing, but it also shows the rest of the world that despite foreign aggression, progress continues to be made. The government of the people continues to work on their behalf as much as it can, despite the opposition from outside forces, and it does so successfully, caring for the people. Certainly, Afghanistan is riddled with problems because of the U.S. war against it, but this will give hope to people and provide them with many more opportunities in a variety of ways, not only economically, but also in being able to do some additional travel and leave their war-torn area, at least for a time. This provides hope to the people, as well as a number of economic benefits.
The Khaf-Herat Railway was mainly implemented by the Islamic Republic of Iran under a tripartite agreement between Iran, Afghanistan, and India.
You better know that Afghanistan is a water scarce, and transportation roads can work as a backbone of the country, considering the fact that Afghanistan has an unsafe situation through the standard transportation system prevalent across the world. Goods can be transported through railways safely.
Under construction since 2007, the million-dollar project consists of four sections, two of which are in the Iranian territory and the other two on the Afghan side. Iran and Afghanistan have also signed a memorandum of understanding with five other countries that are on the way of the East-West Corridor, including Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, and further negotiations are still ongoing in this regard.
During the inauguration ceremony, the presidents of both countries hailed the project as a way to increase trade and transit across the region. As Iran's sixth border railroad with neighboring countries and first with Afghanistan, the train track will connect Afghanistan to Iran's large rail network, further strengthening the bond between the two countries and helping Afghanistan become the transit crossroad it has dreamed of so long for becoming.
Speaking during an inaugural ceremony held via video conference due to the COVID pandemic, authorities and officials from Iran and Afghanistan described the railroad as a significant step toward creating a more robust network of international trade and transit of goods. President Rouhani called it a historic day in relations between the two great nations of Iran and Afghanistan and expressed hope that the project serves as a framework for more infrastructure development and economic investment.
It will have a significant impact on prospects for economic, social, and cultural exchange in the region. For one thing, the new railway is expected to transport as many as 1 million passengers between the two cities a year and up to 6 million tons of goods a year. The possible economic benefits for both nations is really beyond what we can comprehend almost. It's incalculable. This will allow Afghanistan to receive many more goods and services at a reduced price, goods and services that they need, goods, equipment, building equipment. Just recently, one of the first shipments was 400 tons of cement that's desperately needed in that nation. So as far as economically, they'll be able to trade much more easily with several ports in Iran. It will enable them to have proximity to a variety of different sources for goods in Iran. Additionally, this will give incentive to Afghanistan, to the Afghanistan government, to extend the railway within their country and connect with other nations. Afghanistan, of course, is landlocked and must move its goods either by road, by truck, or by rail. So having an efficient railway system connecting the two countries will encourage further not only trade and cultural exchanges, but also will encourage the nation to expand and extend the railroad. The opportunities for travel, for having even academic exchanges, sporting goods exchanges, and so on, greatly increases. So from a cultural viewpoint, there is that advantage, and people being able to just visit. So socially, economically, and culturally, this railroad has many, many advantages for both nations, and especially for Afghanistan, which, as I mentioned before, has been decimated by U.S. war for 20 years.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif noted that the Khawf-Herat Railway's significance is not only for Iran and Afghanistan, but for the greater region. As a gateway that will boost trade and people-to-people exchanges, it will also contribute to regional stability and development. Turning our frontiers into bridges is a priority, the Iranian top diplomat said. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, for his part, called the project a historical plan that is crucial for trade and economic development throughout the region. Ghani noted that completion of the Khawf-Herat Railway during the pandemic era is an indication of both sides' strong national determination. Underlying the significance of the railway, Ghani called it the starting point for the revival of foreign trade and economic development in Asia.
To me, as a citizen, the railway line can have many benefits to the development of the country's economy. For instance, we can name the Herat-Khawf railway line that can prevent corruption in some of the departments, especially those on the border, and will minimize delay in transporting goods. We are hopeful that the Afghan government takes effective steps in expanding other routes just like this Herat-Khawf railway network.
According to experts and officials, the Khawf-Herat railway is important not only for Iran and Afghanistan, but also for the greater region, as it can complete a continental line of transport from the Oriental world to the West. The ultimate plan is to make Afghanistan connected to all parts of Asia, including the subcontinent, the Iranian plateau, and the Arabian Peninsula, even the North American plate in Siberia.
Before the opening of the Khawf-Herat Railway, Afghanistan had three railroad lines but no passenger rail service. The first is between Mazar-e-Sharif and the border town of Harutun in Balkh province, which then connects with the railway network of Uzbekistan. This part is online since 2011. The second track, which links Turgundi in Herat province to Turkmenistan, is working since 1960. The third, which opens in 2016, is between Akina in Faryab province and neighboring Turkmenistan. The rail link from Herat to Khawf is planned to transport both cargo and passengers, heralding a new era of transportation for the people of Afghanistan.
It has the potential to greatly change and enhance and improve their lives. As it is now, transportation from one area to another is very difficult because of the bombings, the U.S. troops and so on that are there, and the extreme poverty that the country suffers from, mainly because of the U.S. war. Having a railway through the country will enable people to travel to more peaceful parts of the country, enable them to visit relatives, perhaps who they haven't been able to see in some time because of the war and the inability to travel. Having easy transportation to different parts of the country will enable them to access different markets. This will benefit the people who are buying, but it will also benefit the people who are selling. So the ability for the Afghan people to travel within the country and between Afghanistan and Iran will bring many, many benefits to them, and that will cause significant positive changes in their lives.
Moreover, Afghanistan and India are working on extending the rail route from Herat to Mazar-e-Sharif. Mazar-e-Sharif is already linked with Uzbekistan and Tajikistan via rail routes. Herat is already linked with Turkmenistan via rail and road routes. India is also finalizing a plan to construct a 900-kilometer railway line that will connect the southeastern port of Chabahar in Iran to the mineral-rich Haji Gak region of Afghanistan.
Although the Afghan government is struggling with economic challenges and the war among militant groups, government itself, and the U.S.-led troops, it is committed to priorities such as the national flagship development, transportation, and infrastructure projects, and is especially determined to deliver the railway projects on time. Kabul knows that connecting the industrial park in Herat province with global markets will create many facilities for imports and exports, as it costs much less to transport goods by railway than by road. and it also takes less time to reach the destination.
Railways are the backbone of the economy in every country, and Afghanistan, as a landlocked country, is in urgent need of nationwide rail lines that would help connect Afghanistan to international waters through the neighboring countries.
I'm a resident of Herat. With regard to Herat Khaf railway line, jointly developed by Afghanistan and Iran, it can be good for people-to-people contact as well as export and import between the two countries. It will also provide works to the people. I appreciate this Herat Khaf railway link.
In addition to direct economic benefits of a national rail grid, railroad development projects can create thousands of jobs for the unemployed and for young educated Afghans, most of whom have to look for employment in neighboring or Arab countries.
About the Herat Khaf railway line, it would create jobs for us, would prevent corruptions at customs on the border, and would boost import and export.
Once completed, the Khaf-Herat link will have the reported capacity to transport 6 million tons of goods and 1 million passengers annually. This would help Iran and Afghanistan create a vast transit hub between Europe and Asia, through which commercial goods and passengers can reach from the farthest parts of Asia to the ports of the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman.
Afghanistan and Iran are located very strategically for that purpose. And as they become a hub for trade between Asia and Europe, it will increase their economy greatly. It will give them both more stature in the Middle East and in the world. Afghanistan, of course, has been beleaguered for years. Iran is a powerful nation that has suffered economically due to U.S. aggression, but has stayed strong. Being a central hub for trade between a significant part of the world, economically, the Asia-European trade is extremely large. And with products being able to be shipped more efficiently and therefore more inexpensively, with Iran and Afghanistan as the hub, this will change the economic equation in the world, giving more importance to Europe and Asia, and decreasing their reliance on North American products that they need on a regular basis.
Strengthening the position of Iran and Afghanistan in the east-west corridors, the Khaf-Herat Railway may be the key to revive the ancient Silk Road trade routes and help China materialize its ambitious Belt and Road Initiative.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to add more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Shakil Ahmed Rameh, who is a political economist. Mr. Rameh, welcome to the subcontinent. So, what is the significance of the Khaf-Herat railway project? Why is it so important for the region?
So, it is important because any initiative for the connectivity to enhance the economic opportunity or create some opportunity for people-to-people connection is always a good. It brings with it own dynamics and own opportunities, which in the long term benefit the people and largely in the people and the governments of the both countries which are connecting.
So you mean it will bring economic, social and political opportunities. Could you elaborate more on the economic aspect? How will the Khaf-Herat Railway change the prospects for trade in the region?
Definitely, it is a new avenue for Afghanistan and Iran to connect, and it will also an avenue where the other regional countries and the beyond the region countries can also connect. For example, India can also be connected with it through the Chabahar and creating some other linkages. It will also open the new opportunity for India. But it also can create opportunities if this railway road is being connected to the east-west railway corridor. That would be a very key question, because right now the China and Kazakhstan and other countries are talking to Afghanistan and Iran. Iran and Afghanistan looking at the opportunity how to connect it to the east-west corridor. If it is connected to the east-west corridor, that will open a new, era of development for the region and beyond the region. And also it will open opportunity for Afghanistan specifically, which has been hit by so many problems for the long time. It will also create some, the concrete linkages with the Europe and other countries where they can benefit through the trade. And Afghanistan definitely we can trade in the different products. They have a different products to offer, especially in the form of the different fruits and dry fruits and also some minerals. So, but the fundamental question would be again, how it will be connected to the east-west corridor, one thing. Second thing, so how the Russia will take the next step, because we know that the Russians already have constructed some railway in the Afghanistan Uzbekistan border. How they will, either they are going to connect it to Afghanistan, either they are going to connect it independently, or they are going to connect, they create some linkages with this Herat railway road. If they are going to build the connection with the Herat and the Herat railway road, definitely it will also create some opportunities. But more important would be how Iran and Afghanistan work with the regional country to create to go for the cooperation. From my perspective, if Iran and Afghanistan go for the cooperation, then it can be a real game changer. If they are not cooperating, or if they want to take it to a solo flight, it will be, I don't think so, that there will be some success, because Pakistan also have its edge through the CPEC, and if you look at Spain, Baltic, Pakistan can also go for connection with Afghanistan, and it would be shorter route. And again, China is building CPEC in Pakistan. They're from Kashgar to the Pakistan. They're bringing the routes and now working on the railway links. So that's why I suggest Iran and Afghanistan will have to cooperate and looking for the cooperation with the regional countries to make it a success.
Mr. Rome, please let's just take a quick look at how the global media has covered the situation.
The Khaf-Herat Railway has a total of 218 kilometers in four sections, the first and second sections of which are from Khaf to Shamtir in Iran, with a length of about 76 kilometers, and the third section is from Shamtir to Ruznak, with a length of 62 kilometers in Afghanistan. This international railway has an annual capacity of 1.8 million tons of cargo transit from the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, countries, Turkey and the Persian Gulf, said Iran's Deputy Roads and Urban Development Minister Said Rasouli. The Asian Development Bank has conducted a credible analysis on railways in Central Asia regional economic cooperation countries, which include Afghanistan, with regards to their huge investment potential between 2017 and 2050, President Ghani said. Based on this study, Afghanistan needs to build 2,440 kilometers of railway, and the initial estimate for building 1,295 kilometers of railway is more than $2.2 billion, he said. The Khaf-Herat Railway will contribute to the development and strengthening of economic, social and cultural relations between Iran and Afghanistan by facilitating the export and import of goods and the transport of passengers between the two countries. It will provide Afghanistan the rail access through Iran and further to the international market, including southern access to maritime transport, including to Caucasus, Turkey, Iraq and Europe. The line is part of the East-West Rail Corridor, linking the transport network of China to Europe through Iran and Afghanistan. Local officials estimate that Afghanistan can import 2 million tons of goods annually from Iran via the Khaf-Herat link. Besides freight, the railway will also carry passengers. According to the spokesman for Afghanistan's finance ministry, the project also will reduce Kabul's dependence on Islamabad for trade. It will more than anything reduce reliance on Pakistan. It's part of our regional connectivity mega plan. Afghanistan needs affordable and connected transportation for its economic growth and trade balance. Railways offer that platform. We can connect not only with Iran, but also the wider region, he said.
Welcome back, Mr. Romay, and welcome back to the audience as well. Mr. Romay, you earlier mentioned that it is important to look how the East and West could be connected with this corridor. Now, with this rail line, Iran and Afghanistan are set to become the transit hub for all the exports from China, India, and all the countries along the way to Europe. What are the implications of this for the future of trade in Asia and Europe?
Look, as I said already, if we are going to take Kiev and the Herat Railway Road as a new hub of, you can say, the transit trade, so we have to look at the dynamics. As I mentioned already, if this would be able to create linkages with the East and West Railway Corridor, then it can be. And we also have to look the middle corridor, which is being under construction in Central Asian states by the Turkey. So how Turkey is going to build these connections with other corridors? If Herat and Kiev is able to build a connection with them, we have to look that. Then the important question would be, if we are talking about from India to bringing it to Afghanistan and taking it to, you can say, the Europe or from other destinations, we have to also look at the economic cost. Because when you go to approach a market, you also have to be the competitive. Will India be able, if India is bypassing Pakistan and connecting directly to this corridor to the Afghanistan and the Central Asian states, so what would be the economic cost? For example, the travel, what would be the travel cost? Will they be able to compensate if some other commodities are coming from other countries which don't have such huge economic, you can say, the travel cost? That would be another factor. And the last factor, again, which I already am emphasizing my first point, so we have to look how they are building the connection, the cooperation with existing different corridors, or you can say different routes. If they are just bringing it like that, oh, this is, everything is going to change, every dynamics will be going to change after that, that would be the question we need to ponder more seriously. Especially when we're talking about it from Herat, if we want to bring it to the Kashgar, to the China. So what would be the economic cost to build that corridor? So what would it be the easier for the Chinese market to come from that route to reach to the Iran or Afghanistan or some other routes, they are more feasible for them. One thing, a second thing, which we have to discuss here. So Iran would also be look at that, how they can connect it to the Middle East. Because at this point of the time, the development status of Afghanistan, maybe they will be in a better position to tap the Middle Eastern economy. Because they need the food and they can export the food. They need some minerals, they can export those minerals. And we have to look at that. Or this road can also facilitate to create the linkages with the Middle East. Again, I will end my answer here. So we need cooperation. And we have to look how Iran and Afghanistan, they are using this railroad network to create the cooperation among the countries.
And that was our episode about the Herat-Khaf Railway and different aspects of it. We'll meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.